Ooh. Gee, it's very nice of you to give me a job helping you, Count. What would you like me to do?
I want you to answer my telephone so I don't have to be bothered while I look for things to count.
Answer the telephone, huh? Is that all?
That's enough. It's not as easy as it seems.
Not easy, huh? Well, listen, you can count on me, Count.
Now, what can I find to count? One ring.
That's the telephone. I'll answer it.
No, I must count them.
Yeah, two rings.
I have to answer the phone there.
No, I'm counting the rings.
Three rings.
I'll get it.
Oh, you tricky Ernie. Four rings.
But I have to answer
five.
Hello? Hello?
Five glorious rings.
That tickles.
Good evening, brothers and sisters, and welcome to another edition of Homebrew Talk, your monthly internet radio program that unlocks the mysteries of Zymergy and spreads the homebrew gospel one carboy at a time. Homebrew Talk brought to you by the great folks at Grow Radio. Check out a plethora of sonic pleasures at their site, growradio.org, for the best in indie music, talk, and all kinds of stuff. We're also brought to you by your Hogtown Brewers, a merry band of beer enthusiasts with a homebrewing problem. We gather together once a month to share recipes, share technique, and, of course, to share homebrew. Check out what we have going on at hogtownbrewers.org. My name is John. I am the head brewer at First Magnitude Brewing Company here in beautiful Gainesville, Florida. And with me, as always, is my homebrew jockey partner, Ron. Ron and I are both members of the Hogtown Brewers, longtime brewers of beer, mead, and cider in the comfort of our driveways, and are both BJCP certified homebrew judges. Hello, Ron.
Hello, John.
You know, the Count is telling me that there's some sort of celebration. This is a milestone today. Is that right, Ron?
Well, first off, you can't go wrong with Muppets.
No, agreed.
We can agree with that. And as the Count was hinting at, this episode marks our five-year anniversary on Grow Radio.
Yo.
Yeah. Demystifying the art of Zymergy, chatting up some beer science, and spreading the homebrew gospel one carboy at a time.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And yeah, you know, also some brew tunes, themed appropriate, of course, as always. So for this five-year anniversary show, we've chosen to do a sequel to the anniversary show number 4, Joe's to Prose,
yeah,
which dealt with opening up your own brewery. So consider this, Joe's to Prose 2, The Wrath of John.
Happy anniversary.
So here's the premise of our show today.
I just want to comment out that you know, we're less than 4 minutes into the show, and we've had Flintstones and the Muppets.
Digging deep into our childhood.
That's 5 years. That's 5 years of gold.
Gold, Jerry. All right. So our premise is now on our fourth anniversary show. That was the original Joe's to Prose episode that we did with First Magnitude Brewing in Gainesville, talking to the owner. That's you, right?
Yeah, that would be
okay,
me.
Just making sure. And that was about a month before it opened, and we're given insights on the challenges to opening a brewery for those interested in such things. Now, fortunately, it did open on time, but
yeah,
that is not to be taken for granted,
that's,
I'm sure.
No doubt.
And now on this fifth anniversary show, we're going to follow that up, see how that turned out, lessons learned, and ponder, you know, if you knew then what you knew now, so that those homebrew jockey Joes who are thinking of going pro can benefit from, you know, some crazy, you know, but real world experience. You know, so why don't we go ahead and do that? And where to begin? Well, to begin with anything, let's talk about the FM pilot system.
Yeah.
How about that?
Yeah, sure. So we our pilot system is a Frankenstein sort of system that
You went with a bigger one.
We did go with a bigger one, and we cobbled it together. It'll do about a barrel and a half of a standard strength, say 1050, 1055 gravity beer, and you know, there was great temptation to go with sort of a plug and play, you know, kind of a system, Brew Magic or something like that, and those are great systems, you know, because you order them and they show up and put it together and you start brewing. But we wanted to do something that had a bigger capacity, and that turned out to be an excellent decision because we use that now to feed our tap room. And being able to get a barrel and a half, barrel being 31 gallons of beer out of it at one pass through the system, it really works because if there's one thing that we've learned is people love variety, and especially with our regulars coming in, they want to know what's new, what's on tap, what do you got this week, and we wouldn't be able to have nearly the variety that we do without the pilot system.
Right. So, granted, that's certainly ideal why you need a pilot system, but you still went with one that gives you a barrel and a half as opposed to something, some quantity much smaller.
Right.
Right.
Oh, yeah.
And I assume that was because, well, the smaller quantity one, you know, you don't have to have as much confidence in how this is going to turn out. Hey, it's only a small amount, but now that it's a barrel and a half, I guess you have to have a little bit of confidence and that's going to come out because you don't want to, you know,
sure,
have a barrel and a half of something that just doesn't cut it, not even for, you know, your tap room.
Right, right. Yeah, well, that's true. But still, you know, it being a pilot and our big brew house being a 15-barrel system, there's certainly less pressure to screw up 46 gallons of beer than there is 460 gallons of beer. But yeah, I mean, we get the recipes fairly dialed in. The pilot does behave a little bit differently than our brew house does. So there are some things we have to take into consideration when brewing on the pilot. But you know, for the most part, it works out really well. And the great thing for us was we got the pilot in May. It had everything together, and we're brewing on the pilot beginning in May. We didn't open until August, and transitioning from the from a homebrew scale, from a 5 to 10 gallon batch scale to the pilot was really more challenging than going from the pilot to the big brew house, mm-hmm. which was huge for us, because you know, the different efficiencies, different hop utilization rates, it really was an enormous help to have that pilot and be able to brew on it and get comfortable on it before we, you know, scaled up to the big rig for sure.
Yeah. So no doubt it gave you, with that size pilot, gave you plenty of quantity that when you are able to get some batches out there, that it sustains you for a while.
Yeah, yeah, definitely. When we opened last August, we had 9 FM beers on tap. And, I think 3 of them were brewed on the big brew house. So having those pilot batches was just absolutely huge. And, you know, it continues, you know, we use it all the time. We brewed on it twice this week. And what's been another kind of side benefit of the pilot that's been a lot of fun, we have a couple of our employees who are Hogtown brewers and help us in doing cellar work and cleaning up and all kinds of things. And they also work in our tap room, but they are very good brewers themselves, and they've been getting more and more comfortable on the pilot, and we have encouraged them to bring in their recipes and scale up some batches, and that's been a lot of fun for them. So it's a really helpful way to keep them engaged and excited, and get us some new great brews too. So
All right. Spreading that brewing wealth around and that experience. So in starting up a brewery, of course, now that it's almost 1 year later, talk about funding.
Funding.
For your brewery, because that... Those are some basic things people need to get a handle on.
Right. Yeah. The funding piece, I have to give great kudos to my wife and my partner Meg, who did an outstanding job in writing up our business plan, which was essential in setting our goals, and as well as having a great document to present to potential investors. We started our fundraising in earnest August of 2013, and we actually had all our capital raised by that next December. So I won't say that the fundraising was easy, but it really wasn't as challenging as I expected it to be. The great thing is you're selling beer, and
as I recall, you were brewing some beer and presenting those at your
right. Yep. Yep. Yep.
Investor.
Yep.
Right. Meetings.
Yeah. Those. That was we launched this thing on Homebrew for sure, and it came out of. Friend of the show, Eric Dreyer, and my driveways, and we were pouring what came to be three of our core beers, Siren 72 and Drift, and just talking up the market here in Gainesville. Still to date, we are the second production brewery in town, and Swamp Head has been around for going on 6 years now, and they've paved the way in so many ways. We were very confident that the Gainesville market could sustain another craft brewery, and so far we've been right about that.
What was the strategy on recruiting investors for you to even talk to?
Well, it started out with friends and family. And some of our investors became evangelists for us, and were great cheerleaders, and they incorporated or they brought in some friends who were interested in getting involved. It's really interesting. We have the whole gambit of investors, ones that are there on a weekly basis. You know, we see them all the time, and we still have some investors that that have never set foot in the door. So it's really kind of interesting. People want to get involved in craft beer for different reasons. It was a really kind of a organic sort of a snowball process that we had a few people that we made the pitch to. And one of our local investors here, he was actually the first person that we made our investor pitch to, and man, he just tore us up. I mean, he just, you know, we
questioning your business plan and strategy and this and
business
that.
Plan strategy. How are you really going to do this? Are you kidding me? You know, just really just raked us over the coals. And we walked out of that meeting with our tails between our legs and just thought, oh man, wow, this.
Good thing that wasn't the very first investor. I guess.
Well, or was he? Okay. Wait, but wait for it. So then he followed that up with an email the next day and said, hey, you know, I really like your beers, and I think you've got something good going here, and I want to get involved. So his real harsh criticism was actually a very good thing, and it pointed out ways that we can improve our investor pitch and
he made you up your game.
Yes, exactly. So, so sometimes those failures can be incredibly helpful.
All right. So this whole time in the past year, or whatever, we've had, and this varies from state to state. You had some laws maybe that you'd have to deal with. Anything in particular? I know this is the state of Florida, and every state's a little different. In fact, I should think that if one is opening up a brewery now in Florida, the climate is actually a little now a little better than it was even a year ago.
Yeah.
Is that correct?
Yeah, that's absolutely correct. You know, much ado has been made, including on this show, about the growler law, the inability for breweries to pour the 64-ounce growlers. And finally, we got that taken care of this past legislative session. But to be honest, that really... It's certainly helpful for us. It didn't you know greatly improve our sales or anything like that. It's really not going to change the way we do business on a day-to-day basis. Really, the most important thing that happened with the change in the law was getting rid of this tourism clause in the state laws. Basically, breweries were able to operate their tap rooms because of Anheuser-Busch's desire in the 70s to be able to sell beer at the Anheuser-Busch Brewery in Tampa at Busch Gardens. And they had an exception to the three-tier system saying that, well, we're promoting tourism, so therefore we should be allowed to do this. And all the breweries capitalized on that. And there was rumblings, especially last year, of breweries not being allowed to do that anymore, that we would actually have to sell our product, as we have to do in every other situation, have to sell our product to the distributor and then buy it back from the distributor to sell it in the tap room. And that would have been a deal breaker for many people starting up, because when you're getting started, that tap room is essential. I mean, when you're waiting and for your distribution sales to scale up, and that just simply takes time. I mean, you can have the best beer and branding and everything, but I mean, it just takes time to get your product out there into the market and get people, you know, excited about it and you know, build your customer base. So while you're waiting for that to happen, being able to have your tap room is essential. And so getting rid of that, so now that tourism clause has been eliminated, and it just simply states in the law that breweries are allowed to have a tap room and sell their own products. And that's just, it's huge. That right. Really would have put the brakes on any, in my opinion, that would have really seriously curtailed any new breweries opening up in Florida if that had passed.
Right. So now they codified it. So there's no open interpretation. Are you a taproom open for tourist purposes? It now explicitly says taprooms can be open. And in fact, you can have up to 8 locations. And I look forward to the 8th location, by the way, for First Magnitude when that comes
You're
up.
Right. You know? Yeah. Yeah.
So on that.
Maybe for the 10-year show.
All right. The clock just started for you. Well, you just mentioned about how the tap room is important for certainly for sales and cash flow for a startup brewery. Take a minute or two and describe your lessons learned about the tap room that FM opened, as compared to also with any other brewery that you've seen.
Right. Well, yeah, we put a lot of thought and effort into our tap room. And one thing, as we were doing our extensive field research, which means visiting as many breweries as possible. Oh, that was hard. One thing that was essential that we all felt was essential is the feeling of being in the brewery. Our tap room has a great window that looks out at all the tanks. Our brewery space is very open, and you know, you're just a few yards away from the brew house and all the fermentation vessels. So that was really important for us, because that's what I enjoyed as a consumer, is going in and seeing, okay, wow, that okay beer that I'm drinking came out of that tank right there.
So you got all that from inspiration from visiting other tap rooms.
Right, right. And
So field trip, very good idea. For getting inspiration of ideas.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, visiting as many as you can and really, you know, taking lots of pictures and, you know, and thinking about it, you know, what do I like, what do I don't like? And then I mean, the field trips were absolutely essential. And so we really strived with our tap room. We wanted to build a sense of community. And obviously it's a place to try great craft beer, but we wanted to develop this place that people felt really comfortable in. And we've been able to do that. We work quite a bit with community groups and special events.
You have quite a few events.
Yeah.
Community events, definitely, in the taproom area.
Yeah, absolutely. And that has proved to be very, very important.
I assume that helps give your patrons an emotional attachment to being at your tap room.
It does. When we're having a fundraiser, say for Springs Eternal, for example, people really feel a connection and feel good about it. And the nice thing about having these fundraisers and different community events is every time we do one of those, we're bringing in new people and bringing in people that may not have otherwise gone to a brewery or maybe aren't really especially into craft beer, but now they've put a foot in the door and wow, okay, this place is pretty cool. I'm gonna start going there regularly.
Yeah, I can back up that story, that sentiment easily, when the Hogtown Brewers did a breakfast at First Magnitude and we got it catered at the locally from the Flying Biscuit, the delivery guy from Flying Biscuit. He's bringing in the food and he looks around and goes, I've never been here before. This is great. He's brought his crowd.
Oh, yeah.
You remember that guy.
Yeah. Oh, I do.
So, yeah, little opportunities like
yeah,
that.
Yeah. Yeah. Absolutely. And it's fantastic when you can have that win-win-win situation. We're raising money for, a good cause. We're expanding our business to new people, and we're selling beer while doing it. So it really, really works out. Okay. Very, very well.
Cool. All right, let's pause right there and let's go off and do an anniversary tune break on Homebrew Talk in the Grow Radio studio.
Five fingers.
One, two, three, four, five.
Five frogs.
One, two, three, four, five.
Homebrew Talk.
Dude, come on. Love my girl. She looking good. Come on. One more.
Five to one, baby, one in five. No one here gets out alive now. You get yours, baby, I'll get mine. Gonna make it, baby, if we try.
Across the floor with a flower in your hand, trying to tell me no one understands. Trading your hours for a handful of dimes.
gonna make it, baby, in our prime. Come together one more time. Get together one more time. Get together one more time.
Get together.
Stop!
All right, we're back. And if nothing else from this show, you will learn to count to five.
No doubt. You know, we started off with the Count's favorite Doors song.
You got it.
5-1. And then you know, in commemoration of the startup brewery that we are, you know, somebody told me the other day that you can be in business for 2 years and still call yourself a startup. So,
oh.
So start me up, Stones, digging it.
Surrender may be our only option.
No, never give up, never surrender.
I did steal that one from the 4th anniversary show. It seemed like it was still appropriate.
I can see the phone lines lighting up now. Oh, dude, you're calling it in. A clip show.
All right, well, you started up. You got a pilot. You also got a big rig. That means getting big amounts of ingredients.
Yeah.
You can't just walk down to your local homebrew store and grab a, you know, a bag or two.
Right, right.
How's that work out?
You know, you're right. You just can't get 12,000 pounds of malt from your local homebrew store.
It just doesn't work that way.
But I will say that we have a fantastic relationship with our the Hogtown Ale Works, which is our local store here in Gainesville. And on occasion, if we're running low on a specialty malt or a small batch of hops for our pilot system, we call on those guys all the time.
Yeah, and enjoy the shout out, guys.
Yeah, for sure. But we order malt pretty much every 2 months. We get about 12,000 pounds in, and that's a real challenge to kind of figure all that out. It's mostly base malt, as you would expect, but we do need to think about what are the specialties that we use, you know, really often. The great thing about malt is it's got pretty good shelf life. It's basically, we crack all our malt on site. We have a mill and all that. So
is it a hand crank?
It takes hours. No, it's the malt will be good for pretty much a year. There's really not an issue with storage or anything like that. But you do have to really think about and try to forecast, you know, what you're going to be brewing and, you know, have sufficient quantities on hand.
Now even us Joes know that big boy breweries, they do hop contracts. Does that apply to malt also, or are you just simply getting you know, the price break from buying in bulk?
Right. No, we don't have to enter into contracts for malt, and occasionally we do run into some scarcity with certain specialty malts. They can be out of stock, and we have to wait to get it in. But for the most part, it's you know, we order it up, and it ships ships pretty quickly. The hops are definitely a different story. Right now, this show's being recorded in 2015. We're contracted through the 2017 harvest. And
so talk about how that actually works, doing hop contracts.
Right. So basically, there's lots of different options out there for hop farms. Some you contract directly with the farm. Other times you're working with a middleman, kind of a hop vendor. But basically what you're doing is you're locking in prices in the future. And this helps us because we have a better idea of, you know, what our costs are going to be. And it also helps the farmers so they know what they need to be focusing on and the varieties that they need to that they need to grow. So the other piece of the hop contracting that's useful is it really forces you to think very carefully about, well, what are we going to be brewing? And then order hops in a sufficient quantity to get that done. But even with the hop contracts, as we learned this year, it's an agricultural product, and the harvest, your harvest may vary. And, you know, being a very small brewery, that we are, we had one of our providers say, well, you know, the harvest wasn't what we thought, and, sorry about that, but you're not going to get all your hops. So that
is there a penalty for the provider in the contract, since it is a contract?
Not really. there's a clause in their force majeure that basically says, well, you know, sorry, they did allow us, or I should say, they gave us the option that we could apply the that portion of the contract to a future year. So this was a case with Centennial Hops in particular. We contracted for 30 44-pound boxes, and they said, well, sorry, didn't have the harvest that we expected. We're only going to give you 23. So they let us out of the contract for those 7 boxes, or they gave us the option and said, look, you know, this isn't going to happen. This isn't happening for the 2014 harvest, but you could apply this to the 2015 harvest if you choose to do so. So that becomes a challenge when you don't have the hops contracted. You can buy them on what you call the spot market, but generally speaking, you're going to pay a lot more money for hops on the spot market. There's all kinds of ways to get around it, but the hop contracts are definitely the best way to keep your costs under control and have a better idea of you know, the ingredients you'll be working with.
Is a hop contract even applicable even if you are going to open a small brew pub as opposed to a bigger distribution brewery?
I mean, you know, if you're going to be putting out beer in sufficient volume, I mean, I know of breweries here in Florida that are, I would say, comparable to our size that don't have hop contracts at all. That they do everything on the spot market. Now, I personally think that's, you know, I think getting your hops locked in is really, really the way to go. But not everybody does it. You know, if you're, you know, if you're looking to open, you know, a brew pub type of situation where you're only going to be brewing on premise, I would still say, because, you know, I mean, you can enter into a contract for, I don't know that there's a minimum amount, but even if you're just doing, you know, a couple hundred pounds of hops, it seems, you know, very worthwhile to me. Anyways.
All right. For all that, all the grain, all the hops that you have to store, although I don't think hops probably take all that much space.
Well, but you more do, than you'd imagine, but yeah.
Right. Probably. Obviously, you've always heard space constraints can be a significant limitation if you don't get the building right. That you choose to go into.
Yeah.
Can you verify that, right?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. You know, without a doubt, we're very fortunate in that we have almost 21,000 square feet.
Which is not typical for a startup.
No. We were again, very fortunate to have found this property. And,
What do you think would be like a, if you didn't run into the good luck of this particular building that you found, what would be like a minimum square footage that you would have been required?
Oh, well, you know, I mean, all told, we probably only actively use about half of our space, 10 or 11,000 square feet. You know, a lot of the building is just used for storage, and but I mean, it's a great luxury for us to have. I mean, just the malt alone. You know, when you're talking 12,000 pounds of malt, you know, that's 8 or 9 pallets that come in, and you need a place to put all that. We're getting ready to go into cans next month, which we're very excited about. But when you order cans, you have to order a truckload of cans. That's 225,224 cans in a truckload. So it's, you know, we're really fortunate that we have that space, because you got to have, you know, room to put all that stuff. Not to mention space for your customers to come in and you know, hang out and enjoy themselves. So, you know, the bigger the better. There's lots of breweries out there that really maximize a small area. You certainly don't have to be as big square footage wise as we are, but I would say, oh, I don't know. I mean, it would be very difficult, I think, to do it in less than 5,000 square feet. That would be very, very tough, I would think.
Yeah, I mean, 5,000 square feet, that's basically the size of a big house, I suppose.
Right, yeah.
All right. Segueing over back to the tap room, mm-hmm. and specifically equipment.
Right.
The tapping equipment that you have for dispensing beer.
Mm-hmm.
Talk about that, including the little lever you got, which is a very handy thing at the point of pouring the beer.
Our sexy Perlick faucets.
Yeah.
Yeah. So we were very fortunate in negotiating with our distributor. They helped us out tremendously with the install and the equipment in our tap room, which was great.
Why did you pick the particular equipment that you did?
The lever that Ron is referring to is a little lever that's actually right there on the faucet that you can adjust the flow rate as you're pouring beer, and it's really helpful in particular when you're filling growlers to be able to speed up or slow down the rate on the tap. So that definitely helps decrease waste, and it's a good feature for sure.
Isn't that feature also helpful for when you have the type of beer that's, say, highly carbonated, so you want to keep the keg at a higher PSI, but of course you don't want it poured at that PSI?
Sure. Yeah, I mean, if you're doing a Hefe, if you're doing something that is going to be carbonated a little bit higher than your average beers, then yeah, that can be a great help there too.
All right. Are you able to talk about the point of sale system that you guys chose, or is that above your pay grade?
You know, a point of sale system is kind of like a roof on your house. You know, it's really hard to get excited about a POS, and you know, there's something else that POS stands for that is applicable. I haven't really heard anybody rave about their POS system, but you know, ours works. It's got its quirks and stuff. It's all based off of it operates off of a tablet iPad format. But you know, it works. It's one of those necessary evils that you have to have. And there's all kinds of things that could be better, but for the most part, it's does its job.
Well, okay. So right outside that tap room, not every brewery's or pub, brew pub can have one, and various breweries have it. Is of course the nice beer garden outside.
Yeah.
Talk about how your ideas of how you wanted to make that one, and you know, the feel of it.
Right.
Because there's all various different ways you can do this.
Yeah, for sure. You know, again, in the first segment, you know, I talked about wanting to really make a great community space. So we have lots of picnic tables, nice, you know, shaded tree canopy. You know, and it's just a large outdoor space with a small stage for music and such, and it's really got a good, I think, just relaxing feel to it, and myself and my partners all have young elementary age children, and so we wanted a space that was you know, really reflected our families and places that we like to hang out. So our brewery is very family friendly, and it's funny. That's a very polarizing thing. When you read online reviews about First Magnitude, people rave and like, "Oh my God, it's great! I love it! It's family friendly! It's fantastic!" And then the next review is, "There's too many kids. This place is ridiculous. You know, what's up with all the children?" But you know, I think having a place, you know, and we have Jenga and different things for kids to do. And
yeah, but there's plenty of breweries that it's mainly by adults that have those same toys too.
Exactly. So I think the family friendly aspect has become a real strength of ours. And you know, parents, young families, is a big part of our demographic, and I think that's really cool.
Yeah, I think you're going to may go in uncharted territory when we find a nice article on First Magnitude and Parent Magazine. That'll be odd.
Yeah.
All right, we're going to pause right here for another Brew Tune break on our anniversary show at Homebrew Talk in the Grow Radio Studio.
Homebrew Talk.
One called a First Year Blues. Now I've been married about 6 months, only 6 months, you see. The first 3 months was all okay, the last three's killing me. My wife began to hiss and she cut out on her kissing, and then she failed to shine my shoes. My shirts became a wrinkle, my pants with dirt was sprinkled, and I took the first year blues. Well, then she started nagging, she left the sink a-sagging with dishes piled up high. The food upon the table, she said, if I get able, I'll cook something by and by. Then I began to wonder if I'd made a blunder when I said I'd do. She must have read my thinking, her eyes began to blinking, and that gal broke in two. Well, I heard the dishes crashing, and I began to dashing, getting out of sight. For right there was my honey, on who I'd spent my money, turning into dynamite. Then after she'd exploded, her meanness all unloaded, and things began to simmer down. I found myself a-bleeding and very much a-needing of stitches taken all around. Well, then she started crying, felt myself a-sighing, and then I took her in my arms. I was afraid to scold her, so I just gently told her she didn't do a bit of harm. Now the first 6 months is over, and I'm much the older and experienced with a wife. If I can take the next 6, my friends all say I'll be fixed to take it the rest of my life.
Homebrew Talk.
Thank you.
All right, we're back, and hey, those two songs, basically the mantra of the startup.
You know, fortunately, we're not singing too many first-year blues like Hank Williams was there, and, you know, there's just not enough bagpipes in rock and roll.
I've always said that.
That
second song?
Yeah, and that second song was Long Way to the Top, and I'm not suggesting we're at the top, but...
No.
It has been a long way.
And still climbing, of course.
Right.
Yeah, let's figure out what's brewing elsewhere. All right, for a couple of minutes, we're going to go back to Bein' Joe's. Now, the 2015 BJCP guidelines are going to invade your life starting November 2015. And that's when the BJCP exams are going to start using those 2015 guidelines. And the BJCP expects all competitions to use them by the end of the year. So that's, if you haven't counted, that's 34 categories you can look forward to enjoying and relishing.
Yikes. Yikes. All right.
So if you're an AHA member, and I hope you are, a podcast that gives a pretty good insight of the specific changes of the 2015 guidelines as compared to the 2008 guidelines, that can be found at the AHA website at homebrewersassociation.org. This is what you do. You go to that website, on the menu, hover over the menu item, Let's Brew. Don't click it. You just hover over it. Then, in the pull-down menu, click on Conference Seminars. Then you just look up the 2014 seminar for the 2014 BJCP guidelines by Gordon Strong. Obviously, it was later renamed the 2015 guidelines, but I guess they got really optimistic in that year. But for the most part, everything said in that podcast does apply to the final draft of the guidelines. So, hey, there you go. Look those up. All right. Hey, John, thanks for being a guest again. This is your second time being a guest.
Yeah, pretty cool. Pretty cool.
So,
enjoying all the perks of being a guest on Homebrew Talk.
Yes, you know, the wait in the green room with the fruit tray and the it's quite exquisite back there. You know. So, any last thoughts on for those Joes thinking of going pro?
Wow. Well, there's many. One thing that I will say is that has been a great surprise. Well, I don't know, not so much a surprise, because, you know, I've heard an awful lot about, you know, the craft brewing community being, you know, very helpful and supportive of one another, and I have found that to be 100% true. I mean, we reach out to other breweries almost on a daily basis. And I've just found people to be very helpful, sharing insights, sharing experience. I mean, it's just been great, and it's wonderful for us that now that we've got almost a year under our belts, that people are reaching out to us and asking us questions, and we've received so much help. It feels great to be able to give that back a little bit. So. If you're thinking about making this plunge yourself, just recognize that there are no stupid questions, and you got to ask them. You really do.
All right. Well said, well spoken. Now, John, trade out your hat. Go back to being a homebrew jockey, because obviously here at Homebrew Talk.
Like we always say here at Homebrew Talk, support your local breweries and your local craft beer bars. And if you are so inclined, give us a like on the Book of Phases.
All right, 5 years and still counting. We're done here at Homebrew Talk. We'll be back next month. But if you can't wait, you can always check out our past podcast at homebrewjockey.com.